studies have shown that the farm soil we get our vegetables from is dead, meaning it is depleted of minerals. Sulfur is a mineral. Sulfur has been depleted from the soil, which means most people have been depleted of sulfur. Sulfur has been found to transport oxygen throughout the body. You need oxygen. You need organic sulfur. American Voice Radio Network has organic sulfur. Go to AmericanVoiceRadio.com and then to the Superstore to order your organic sulfur. It's your choice. Do you want to feel better or not? Don't forget to tune in to the Sulfur Hour Plus One on AmericanVoiceRadio.com Thursdays, 6 p.m. Pacific. Prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. My co-host, Alfred Addisk, will be joining James Corbett of the Corbett Report for their weekly segment, and that will begin and end during the second and third segment for the program today. And today is Thursday, April 9th, 2015. But Wendy Wilson will be joining me with her weekly tips on staying healthy, and she is with Apothecary Herbs. But first, let's get to the markets today, and the markets are as strange as ever today. You have gold trading down 820 right now at 1195. Silver is down 35 at 1626. Platinum is down 10 at 1160. But palladium traded higher, up 8 at 766. And the pressure on the dollar, the pressure on gold today was due to a stronger dollar, 1.02 to the upside at 99.10 for the dollar. Crude oil was up 25 at 50.67. And the paper markets today, you have the Dow closing out at up 56 points, 17,958. You have the NASDAQ up 23 at 4,974. And you have the S&P up 10 at 2,091. 10-year yield, 1.96. And the euro, of course, with the dollar trading stronger in the index, you have all other currencies trading weaker. So you have the euro, 106. Down 1.24, almost the same amount as what the dollar is up. And it wasn't that long ago the euro was 110, just few days ago, a week or so ago, European markets, Asian markets were up higher, strongly. Hong Kong was up almost 3%. Germany was up over 1%, as was London. For all your gold and silver coin needs, give us a call at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. We got some great prices on 90% silver. Give us a call. It's a great little product to have. It's a great way to get your silver for any type of extreme emergency. It is good to have. We also have silver eagles and, of course, all fractional gold. And, of course, I believe fractional gold coins are much better than those little bars and grams that you can purchase. Right now, I'd like to say hello to Wendy Wilson from Apothecary Herbs. Good afternoon, Wendy. I believe she needs to be... She has to have an on button somewhere.
I'm sorry. Sorry, it's me. My fault. Hello, Melody.
Hi, Wendy.
I'm having headset problems today. I told Frank he connected me, and then I moved, and everything disconnected. My fault. So anyway, I'm here.
All right.
Fine.
Are you sure you just didn't have the mute button on?
Well, that was the second thing. Okay.
Oh.
So it's one of these technically challenged days for me. I'm sorry. Well, we're going to talk about fleas today because this is the season for them, especially if, you know, people out there with pets. And actually, the flea issue is exploding all over the United States, Melanie. Areas in the United States that say they have big flea problems already are in the southeastern, also in San Diego, California, and parts of Connecticut and Pennsylvania. So actually, I got this quote from a Dr. Michael Dryden. He's a professor of veterinarian parastology at Kansas State University. He's also known as Dr. Flea, so he knows fleas. And he also says that vets now are doubting the efficiency of the flea treatments that they recommend to their customers because they're not working as well as they did 15 years ago. And also Dr. Christine Kane, who's also a professor of dermatology at the University of Pennsylvania School of Veterinary Medicine, she says the flea outbreaks can occur in your pets even regardless of them being treated by the vets with these products for fleas. So there's a real problem. And as we get warmer, rainy days and, you know, summer sets in, we're going to see, according to the experts, a flea bloom. So I know you have a pet. How do you do with fleas, Melanie?
I never had problems.
Okay, good.
I don't take them to parks. They don't associate with a lot of strange dogs and so forth. You know, they might associate with the neighbor's dogs, but other than that, you know, I keep them contained in the area to certain areas, and that's it.
Well, that's good. Good. I'm glad you're taking precautions because, as you could possibly imagine, fleas do multiply pretty quickly. Actually, experts in major cities like New York are worried about a plague outbreak with bubonic. The rock squirrel flea is a primary vector for plague, especially in the state of Colorado. They actually say, or some speculate, I should say, that song Ring Around the Rosie, that nursery rhyme, may have gone back to the 1700s and originated during a plague outbreak because depending on the plague bacteria, your skin can actually get a red ring discoloring to it. Also, there's this one flea. I never heard of this, Melanie. There is a beaver flea, okay? And I'm so glad it prefers mountain beavers because this thing is a quarter of an inch long.
A what?
Yeah, it's a flea that likes beavers, and it's a special species of flea, and it's a quarter of an inch long. So it's one of those things you can actually see.
Wow, well, that's one I don't want to see.
Well, I know, but I'm so glad it prefers mountain beavers, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
There's 80, actually, the state of Colorado.
Beware of those mountain beavers. Go ahead.
Well, Colorado is probably the worst states for fleas because it has 80 different flea species. It also has a species of flea that likes to bite humans called the Pluex irritus. And even though it's found on wild animals like skunks, foxes, and coyotes, it's when those animals abandon their dens that the fleas tend to scatter, and then they'll jump on household pets and then on you. Also, cats can multiply cat fleas, I should say, can multiply on both dogs and cats. So the most common state that has flea problems on a majority of the time is Texas, California, and Florida. So I just want to mention the flea is pretty amazing. It's small, but it's busy. Let's see, female fleas can lay 2,000 eggs during their lifespan or 50 eggs a day. The incubation time is a few days to a couple of weeks, depending on the conditions.
And that's always the problem, yeah.
Right. And under ideal conditions, a pair of fleas, mama and papa flea, they can produce 2 trillion fleas in just 9 months. And so, you know, the fleas can fall off your dog into your carpets and bedding and so forth. And then you can have a real problem. Fleas, they can jump 8 to 34 inches high. So that's 150 times its size, or if the human equivalent would be 1,000 feet, if you could jump 1,000 feet. And fleas can jump horizontally about 13 inches. So, and if you wonder how they're able to navigate through all that fur and hair on animals, it's because they have several pairs of legs which have hair-like bristles that help them maneuver, as well as their back legs for jumping. So
it's like swinging through the trees, except they're swinging through.
Yes, that's right. And, of course, you know, their favorite thing on the menu is blood. They will suck up 15 times their body weight in blood every day. And a female flea needs a better blood supply because of her egg-laying capabilities. They do survive several weeks to a few months. So some of them can be pretty hardy. Some of the species of fleas can withstand freezing conditions. So I didn't know that. I thought, you know, you heard that thing, after the first frost, no more fleas. Sometimes that's not the case.
Well, you mentioned Texas, California, and Florida as being, you know, three of the major states. What would those three states have in common, other than massive amounts of people in those states? But is it the southern exposure? Is it the humidity in those?
Yeah, it would definitely be the conditions. They have ideal conditions for flea populations, definitely. Warmer climates. The fleas prefer warmer climates, but they can survive in colder ones, as we all know, because if you've lived up in the north, you have fleas, but you get more of them as you move south. Now, some of the things I wanted to mention about the pharmaceutical flea products that you usually get at your vet, they can range depending on $39 to $80 on top of the vet visit. So most people are trying to get a lot of those pharmaceutical flea products overseas to save 30%. But according to the Natural Defense Resources Defense Council, they said the chemicals that are used in the flea products are alarmingly toxic to not only the pets but also to humans. So they have chemicals in them that are called tetrolophophorus or Priloxer, and young children, they say, should never be exposed to these chemicals. And they're often used in the flea and tick collars, the sprays and powders. So ticks can lick this chemical right off the collar, and they are a nerve toxin that can affect the pet and also the human nervous system. So if you get too much of the chemical, you may experience nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, wheezing, sweating, and watery eyes. So if your pet's being poisoned, look for muscle twitching, drooling, seizures, and things like that. But according to the Humane Society of the United States, hundreds of pet owners report deaths from the flea and tick chemicals each year. And studies report that long-term exposure to these chemicals in smaller doses can produce a cancer risk. And I think it was in the Journal of Pediatrics in 2012, they said that the exposure that toddlers get just by hugging on their dogs every day, not including sleeping, can exceed the EPA's acceptable dose level risk for these chemicals. You still there?
Yes, I am.
Okay. All right. So, I think people need to look at other solutions if they want to avoid the toxicity risk. I think pet owners and parents need to, you know, look at what the risks are and see what other alternatives they have. Of course, there are some natural solutions. That's what we're here for. And our ancestors had fleas. I mean, so this is nothing, you know, new. So they used to wash bedding and clothes in garlic and thyme to help repel the parasites. And then they would use essential oils in the household to repel these parasites, like tea tree oil, citronella, rosemary, peppermint, and eucalyptus. Now, some pet owners, Melody, have told me that they'll give their pet brewer's yeast or garlic, which will enter the blood system and make the blood supply not so tasty to the parasites. Another pet owner said that she sprinkled garlic powder, not garlic salt, but garlic powder on her pet, and it cut down on the fleas. And then another recommendation from a customer.
That's great if you have an outside dog.
Yeah, another one said diatomaceous earth applied to the fur also helped. So you want to vacuum, of course, keep the house clean, but just be sure to dispose of the vacuum bag right away, or use a vacuum that has like I use the Rainbow. It has a water bin, and everything goes into the water so the fleas won't, you know, escape and come out back out into the house. Also, if you're dwelling, if you're spraying around your dwelling to cut down on these pests, you want to protect the predators for fleas, and that would be ladybugs and dirtworms. So don't apply chemicals that would affect them if you can. Also, what I do is I use some eucalyptus and citronella and some other things that are all infused into this plastic pet collar. So these oils won't come and irritate the pet's skin, but you do have the aroma of the herbs coming off the collar. So it does do a really good job of repelling these parasites. And then I also use a shampoo with similar essential oils in it, and it keeps them soft and fluffy and moist, that the skin's not dry and itchy. So it's a natural way of dealing with the flea and ticks without having to use the toxic chemicals. So if anybody's interested, we have them on our website at thepowerherbs.com, and there's a big banner, and you can click on the banner and check those things out. All organic, non-toxic way to deal with fleas and ticks this year.
I need to get in touch with you. I need to get some of that, because I just gave Ruby her first treatment for heartworm. She's almost 2 years old. Do you have something for heartworm?
Well, we typically use black walnut. It's an anti-parasite herb. It's got natural iodine, which those parasites don't like. You can also add some other anti-parasite herbs to her diet, like wormwood and things like that, which would help with that as well. I think that if your dog is your dog outside dog or is it inside dog?
She's inside.
She's inside. All right. Mm-hmm. You know, usually the risk is low for heartworm if she's mostly inside. I know a lot of people give all that medicine to them because they're worried about mosquitoes.
Mosquitoes
and things.
Well, so, I'm in a high mosquito.
Are you? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, you could occasionally just give her a little black walnut just as a prevention if you want. That's what I would do if I was you. That's what I do for my lab, as well as sometimes I'll give him a short burst of garlic, which is also the parasites don't like the sulfur in the garlic, but we're only using a short burst, so we're not using a whole lot of it. Mm-hmm. So there's some options there. But if anybody's interested and they don't have internet access, they can definitely call. Our number's toll-free at 866-229-3663, 866-229-3663. The flea collars are about $7, and I think the shampoo's a few bucks more. And you'll be glad you did that. Believe you me, you'll be glad. Your pet will smell sweet and love you.
I do need to get some of that because I just gave her the heartworm, but I also had the stuff that you put on the back of her neck, and I just couldn't do it.
Well, it's a neurotoxin.
I didn't want to do that, I do need to get something.
Well, send me an email so I don't forget, and I'll pop some in the mail to you.
All righty. Fantastic. We're out of time, Wendy. Thank you for joining us today. Why don't you give out your number again?
866-229-3663 or thepowerherbs.com. Thanks, Melody.
Thank you, Wendy. We'll see you next week. Stay tuned, folks. Alfred and James Corbett will be here with you in just a few moments.
job stress, financial obligations, or relationship problems have you feeling stressed out? When life is too much to handle, use Apothecary Herbs' emotional stress formula. Feel calm and more in control with herbs especially combined to provide the organic nutrition your system needs to help you cope. Complete instructions for maximum benefit and a money-back guarantee. You've waited long enough. Call Apothecary Herbs now. Toll free, 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at www.thepowerherbs.com.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family. American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
Folks, I'm Alfred Addisk, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188 for all your gold and silver coin needs. My guest is James Corbett from the Corbett Report. James has been living and working in Japan since 2004. He started the Corbett Report in 2007 as an outlet for independent critical analysis of politics, society, history, and economics. He's also an editorial writer for the International Forecaster. A very intellectual guy. All right. Always look forward to talking to James. Hello, James. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. How are you doing today, Alfred?
Good. How's your voice today? Last week you were
On the edge of losing it, wasn't I? But no, I'm okay now. I'm feeling good. A lot better and ready to go.
I've got an article here from Mish's Global Economic Trend Analysis. Mish Shedlock, you're probably familiar with him. The Obama Doctrine, an astonishingly good deal. This is a headline for one of his articles, and what he's talking about, the astonishingly good deal. Mish believes that the agreement that's been reached or at least approached with Iran has been astonishingly good. Right? And he may be right. Is it? Do you think this is a good deal for the United States, a good deal for Iran? Who's it good for? Do you agree with that, or is it something dangerous and something we should watch out for?
I think there's an underlying nuclear hypocrisy that goes across the board when it comes to issues like this. But within that framework of the underlying nuclear hypocrisy, I don't have any particular problem with this deal. So for those who don't know, I mean, as Mish points out, there's going to be a series of concessions that Iran is giving in order to basically allay some of the sanctions that have been placed on Iran in what even the White House has called the most aggressive sanctions regime in the history of the world. And people really have to, marvel at the amount of sanctions that have been placed on Iran over the past 4 years, including the delisting of Iran from the SWIFT network, which is basically the international banking lifeline that connects banks to the international grid. Iran and Iran's central bank and several banks within the country were basically taken off of the international grid a few years ago in a move that was eventually ruled to be, if not illegal, at least highly unusual, and I believe SWIFT ultimately reversed that decision. So it's been a quite a hard road for Iran. So this is a good deal, I think, for them, if it does result in actually lifting some of these sanctions and some of this money actually filters back down to the average people working in Iran. Although there is some question about that. So one of the provisions of the agreement that was just reached in Switzerland is that these sanctions, or certain sanctions, will be relieved basically when this deal is made official in June. Interestingly, just yesterday, the EU reinstated a number of sanctions on Iranian banks and shipping companies that had been taken away. They just reinstated them yesterday. So this is after this new interim agreement has been signed, and which I interpret basically as this is a carrot and stick agreement. So they are showing again that they have the stick and letting the Iranians know if you do anything against this deal, then it's going to be a big stick in your face. But anyway, I mean, if there's any good indicator of this deal and the fact that it's probably somewhat fair towards Iran, it's just how much Netanyahu and Israel detests this deal, which is a sign that there's probably something in it that's genuinely for Iran. And in fact, the White House just did a sort of Twitter troll of Netanyahu that you can read about on RT. They have an article up. And basically, people might remember back in 2012, Netanyahu was addressing the General Assembly at the UN, and he had that cartoon picture of the bomb.
I remember. Looked like a Roadrunner. It looked like something from a Roadrunner cartoon.
Absolutely.
From Acme.
Ridiculous. Yeah, propaganda. But so the White House just tweeted out a sort of infographic about this new deal and what it will do that makes fun of that Roadrunner cartoon bomb and basically says this deal cuts the fuse. So I don't know. It's interesting how that plays out. But as I say, this is all part of an underlying regime of nuclear hypocrisy, whereby there is sort of a nuclear club. And if you're not in the club and they don't want you in the club, you're never going to get in the club. And I think that's the deal when it comes to nuclear weapons, when it comes to nuclear power, when it comes to nuclear research. Basically, the people with the nuclear bombs get to determine who else gets to join the club.
I've watched. I will bet that Israel has warned about the danger of Iran getting the bomb, and it's been just 6 more months, and they're going to have it. And I think we've been listening to that off and on for most of a decade. And it defeats a certain amount after a while. You know, we've got a little cry wolf story here where, oh, my gosh, we've been listening. They're going to have the bomb within 6 months. Then, okay, another 6 months and another 6 months. What do you think? Is Iran actually close? Have they been close to getting a bomb? And if so, is that the reason that we agreed to this? Did they even fake having a bomb? Oh, yeah, we're close. We're only 6 months away. It's just like the Israelis say. Were they ever close? Was it ever a threat? And was Israel ever giving us a true assessment of how close Iran was to having the bomb?
Well, I think from all the evidence and everything that's been made available, we can say pretty definitively that there has been no evidence provided that shows that they have been far advanced in their nuclear program, far enough advanced to start to start producing weapons. And again, there's no IAEA report or any inspection so far has proved that they've even come close towards weaponizing this material. So all of that has basically just been speculation and talk. But having said that, I know that it's popular amongst a lot of the alternative media to simply say, well, you know, this is clearly a peaceful nuclear program and the U.S. is just being a bully. Well, yes, I mean, there's always that element to it. But realistically, there is no other reason for any country on the planet to have a nuclear energy program other than to potentially have a nuclear weapons program. I've said it before, I'll say it again. The nuclear energy industry is nothing other than an adjunct to the nuclear weapons production industry, and all those nuclear reactors make mighty fine vehicles for processing uranium into plutonium so that you can develop weapons. So I don't trust any country on the planet that says they have a peaceful nuclear energy program that's all about happiness, because nuclear energy is not economically profitable. The only reason it exists is because it's good for producing nuclear weapons. So I think that it's right to be skeptical of Iran talking about peaceful nuclear energy. However, having said that, again, there's no indication whatsoever, no evidence has been provided that they are even anywhere close towards the production of weapons at this point. And I don't believe any sort of 6 months type of rhetoric. I think that's a bunch of baloney. But keep in mind, that's baloney that's coming from a country that officially, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, doesn't have nuclear weapons, even though everyone knows that it has a nuclear stockpile of at least a couple of hundred warheads, maybe as many as 400. I'm referring, of course, to Israel, which, quote unquote, officially doesn't have nuclear weapons.
Well, what is Israel's complaint with Iran? They seem just absolutely determined they got to bomb that country. What is their complaint? If Iran doesn't have nuclear weapons and realistically wasn't really on path to get any, what has been driving Israel? Just threaten, 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 and try to organize people. We need to bomb them. We need to bomb them. What's your complaint?
I think the underlying point here is the sort of geopolitics of the region. The Middle East region, the natural dominant parties would be, all things being equal, Iraq and or Iran. And so we saw, for example, throughout the 1980s, Iraq and Iran directly fighting with each other for dominance of the region. We saw the U.S. basically supporting one side or another to try to keep that in some sort of balance, I think, as part of a strategy basically to keep them fighting with each other. And then, of course, in the 90s, Saddam Hussein went from the golden boy into the demon boy. And so we saw the years of sanctions and basically destruction of Iraq, and basically taking Iraq out of the picture as a regionally dominant player. So now Iraq is basically divided amongst itself, trying to deal with ISIS, and the country is falling apart in all sorts of different ways. It's been a country in name only, really, for a number of years, as we have the Kurds and other factions taking more autonomy. So Iraq has been taken out of the picture, which, of course, leaves Iran as the region's, I think, naturally dominant geopolitical power, all things being equal. Of course, all things are not equal. So once Iraq is taken out of the picture, we see suddenly the drumbeat of war against Iran. We've seen it for a number of years. We had even McCain talking about during his presidential nomination run-up, you know, bomb, 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 bomb Iran was one of his campaign messages at campaign stops. And we've heard about this for years and years. Iran is next on the list. Iran, Iran, Iran. And I think it's just because, again, it is the only... It is the naturally feasible opponent and natural, I think, enemy of Israel and basically the status quo in.
But also in, Saudi Arabia.
Right now. Yes, exactly.
There's a natural tension based on their religions. They're competing religions between Saudi Arabia and Iran, and Israel, much to everyone's surprise, has allegedly made closer contacts with Saudi Arabia over the years. And there are times when I'm kind of wondering, is Israel threatening to bomb Iran as part of an agreement with Saudi Arabia? Are they acting as a substitute for Saudi Arabia or whatever? Are they attempting to do something that Saudi Arabia can't do? Are they getting money from Saudi Arabia to push for the annihilation of Iran?
Well, I don't know what kind of backdoor arrangement might exist, but I do know that Israel and Saudi Arabia absolutely do have a similar interest in seeing Iran, if not obliterated, at least taken off the table as a potential opponent in the region. And this plays into Egypt and Israel and Saudi Arabia and some of the other players in this region who all, I think, have a stake in this together versus, for example, an Iran or a Yemen or other countries that I think pose a problem to these would-be powers. And it's an interesting dichotomy because, of course, it's framed often in the religious context. So, for example, the Yemen-Saudi conflict that's going on right now, most people will try to pin it down to Sunni-Shia or maybe put it in that framework as type of a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran, because Iran supposedly supports the Houthis, who are the rebels in Yemen. But I think there might be a different way of reading this altogether. Sharmeen Narwani, who was a previous guest on my program, had a very interesting editorial up on RT a week or two ago, "Will Yemen Kick Off the War of the Two Blocks?" where she was talking about how this isn't Sunni versus Shia so much as it is a neo-colonial axis versus a post-colonial axis. So she calls this post-colonial axis a resistance axis, and that's where you find, you know, Iran and Syria and Yemen and some of these other countries that are clearly in the crosshairs right now of Saudi Arabia, Israel, Egypt, U.S., U.K., obviously NATO. So it's an interesting way of looking at it, which I think goes beyond that sort of religious division thing, which there's an element of that, but I don't think it's the underlying geopolitical denominator here.
We had an Arab Spring that began in December of 2010 and continued into 2011, that caused a great deal of turmoil in a number of countries. I think four governments were overturned. I don't know if I'm remembering correctly or not, but they had a great deal of unrest in the Middle East and North Africa based on the Arab Spring. Is that same political energy, does that underlie ISIS right now? Or is ISIS just a completely separate, ISIS comes to me, I see ISIS as something that's been created in a malicious sense and said, let's go out and invade some countries or take over some governments. It doesn't seem to represent the people in the same sense that the Arab Spring represented the emotions and desires of the people throughout the region. Does ISIS feed off that same, is it a second Arab Spring in a sense?
It is certainly part of the turmoil that is taking place in the region and has been at least since the Arab Spring. And I think there's a lot to say about that. But I think that certainly the Arab Spring has allowed room for radicalization, or at least more of radical elements in some of these societies. Especially, I think, notably Egypt, where, of course, we saw the Muslim Brotherhood come to power briefly and then taken away. And I think there's been a lot of that kind of radicalization tension going on in the last few years specifically related to that. So it certainly is, I think, something that helps the sort of recruitment campaign for ISIS at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of different ways that this plays into it. I mean, obviously what happened in Libya, what's been happening and continues to happen in Egypt. The fact that there have been sort of less reported elements of the Arab Spring, of course, certain elements got well reported, like what was happening in Egypt, but other ones, like some of the uprisings that kind of almost sort of occurred in Saudi Arabia but were quickly repressed, don't get reported on because obviously that's more of a U.S. ally, so that we don't ever hear about that, those types of unrest. So, I mean, there's a lot to say about that, but I think, yes, I mean, there is a general turmoil in the region that's been caused by these kind of violent revolutions and counter-revolutions that have been taking place. And that definitely plays into the overall security picture, including what happened in Libya and then what transferred into Syria.
Do you think the turmoil in the Middle East is caused by a rising tide among the people of the Middle East, where they are tired of despots and tyranny, and they're moving, they're at least struggling to get some sort of freedom? Or do you think it's a result of the United States in particular and Western powers in general being unable to maintain the status quo? Are we losing our ability to impose our will in the Middle East, and we see these responses as a reaction to the resulting vacuum?
I think that's a false dichotomy. I think there's at least a third possible option, which is that there was a lot of U.S. State Department and State Department-connected NGOs and others that were directly involved in some of the protest movements that led to the Arab Spring. So I think we have to take that into account and see.
So you're saying the Arab Spring was not simply a legitimate expression of political discontent among the people of the region, that it was to some degree manipulated,
yes,
artificial.
Indeed. Yes. Again, it's a mixture. I mean, it's not. There was a genuine movement that was going on that I think was exacerbated by outside
influence. Crisis is a terrible thing to waste. Let's take a break for some commercials, and I'll be back with James Corbett in just a moment. Please stay tuned to Financial Survival.
A heart condition and emergency rooms and medical doctors are not an option, you need our emergency heart attack kit. 5 concentrated liquid formulas enter the system in 60 seconds to protect your heart muscle, strengthen heartbeat, increase circulation, relieve pain, and make breathing easier. When seconds count, you want all the help you can get with our emergency heart attack kit. Easy to use and portable in a 1-pound compact kit for your purse, briefcase, or car. Call Apothecary Herbs now for your emergency heart attack kit toll-free, 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at thepowerherbs.com.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addis here on Financial Survival with my guest, James Corbett, from the Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. We've been talking about the Middle East. Let's take a look. Let's move north. I'm looking at a map of Russia in an article that was published by Business Insider, and the headline is Russia Fortifying Bases in Arctic Region. And the point behind this is that global warming has apparently contributed to the contraction of the ice, the glaciers and whatever, and ice pack at both the North and South Poles. And the result is we're going to have a northern sea route from the Bering Straits on across to Europe. That'll be open in at least in the summertime, maybe even in the winter. And Russia seems to be lining up and said, we're going to control that. Is this a significant, I mean, is this a minor event, this northern sea route? This opens up, is this just business as usual, no big thing? Or is this a source of certainly concern, maybe conflict? What do you think?
Well, I would be remiss in my duties if I didn't push back on the global warming idea a little bit.
Of course, I know.
The globe is warming and has been for several hundred years since the last mini ice age. But I don't think it's SUVs that are the main contributor to that. But yes, yeah. The point is well taken. The Arctic is becoming more a field of operations militarily and, of course, economically, I think. And there's a lot of different aspects to this, and I think one of them is that the Russians are obviously going to be more involved there militarily, more looking at positioning forces in the region generally, and using naval bases and the like. So I think that is a documentable phenomenon. However, I think the excluded part of that is, well, what about NATO? And of course, all of the NATO countries are equally interested in the Arctic, and we are seeing it becoming more of a geostrategic prize. And so I think that there is a general armament that's taking place there that we see reflected in even the rhetoric that's coming, for example, from the Canadian government. So what does Canada ever say? They're so pacifist and they never make trouble on the world stage. Well, of course, the Harper government has been talking for years about the need to militarize the Arctic and claim the Arctic and all of this type of rhetoric. And we see that basically across the board for every country that has a foot in the water, as it were. They're all trying to talk like this and try to militarize. So, yes, Russia is doing this, but it's part of a broader phenomenon that's going on right now as the sort of plundering of Arctic resources becomes more and more feasible for a number of reasons. I mean, technologically speaking, as well as increased access because of warming temperatures.
We've got, and I agree with you, I am skeptical of the global warming arguments, the way they're being presented, but nevertheless, I remember clearly when I was a kid, there was a lot of snow on the ground in northern Illinois, and that's just, in the wintertime, there was plenty of snow. Right? It was, and it just isn't the case anymore.
The globe has been warming for 400 years. It's just a question of what's causing it.
Well, they had perhaps early SUVs that were destroyed with Atlantis. Maybe Atlantis, and maybe they took all the SUVs are down at the bottom of the Atlantic or someplace. Here's another article on the same idea from Mises Daily. It says, who owns the North Pole? The battle for the North Pole is snowballing between national governments along the Arctic Circle, as they all have their eyes on the vast natural resources residing in the Arctic region. Indeed, it's estimated that the Arctic ocean floor contains 22% of all unused oil and natural gas in the world, the largest remaining untapped concentration. So there's a prize up here, but who does own it, and how are they going to decide, okay, this is my territory, that's your territory over there, how will this territory be divided?
I think like any other geostrategic prize, it's ultimately going to be the one with the most guns can be the winners. And I don't think this is going to be any different particularly. International treaties and things of that nature are only as good as the participants who are participating in them. And if those participants are fighting, I mean, all bets are off the table. So as we see the rhetoric increase about militarization of the Arctic, I think that's going to be the deciding factor ultimately as to what ultimately happens to these prizes. Because, again, I mean, people can lay whatever kind of claims they want. It's just a question of whether they can back them up. And at this point, I mean, no one's a clear winner at this point, but clearly the stakes are being claimed at this point.
Yep. Another article here. We'll move to Europe and Germany in particular. Massive police mobilization against anti-austerity protests in Frankfurt, Germany. German police launched a massive crackdown on protests against austerity in Europe on Wednesday, between 10,000. And this actually goes back into middle of March. This is not a fresh article per se, but my point, given that these apparently massive demonstrations are taking place in Germany, what do these actually say about austerity and anti-austerity? Is this something, you know, people hear about it, Greece doesn't like the austerity measures, okay. Where are these 20,000 demonstrators coming from that between 10 and 20,000 in Frankfurt who participated in a demonstration against austerity? Did they bus them all in from Greece? Are they coming from Spain? Or are they German people?
I wouldn't be surprised if the majority of them are German people, locals, because, I mean, I think we should keep in mind that Europe is generally speaking, much further to the left politically than the United States. And I think there are a lot of people in Germany that are very concerned about what's happening through the auspices of the European Central Bank, which, let's remind ourselves, is headquartered in Frankfurt. So I think this is why those particular protests were taking place last month. Again, I think there are a lot of people who are very concerned about this. In the similar way that there are a lot of Americans who aren't happy with Obama and the things he does, there are a lot of Germans who aren't happy with the direction that that Germany's going in, generally speaking. So it wouldn't surprise me at all if this was an authentic protest by a lot of homegrown German protesters. And I think it is reflective of the sort of growing reality in Europe generally. I mean, we're often subjected to this from sort of the macroeconomic view, where you have the northern states, specifically Germany and France, are kind of versus the southern states like Greece and Italy and others that are seen as freeloaders on the system or burdens on the system. But I think, yeah, there's an element of that, and I'm sure a lot of people play into that. But I think generally speaking, people are not so happy about what's happening in the Eurozone, generally speaking. And I think those types of cracks are coming to the surface, and we're going to see a lot more of this as Greece continues to totter and potentially, I mean, we've said this before, but really is closer than ever to actually exiting the Eurozone. And in recent weeks, we've had inside documents leaked showing that the ECB is preparing for a Greek exit from the Eurozone, and the Greek government itself is preparing for an exit from the Eurozone. Again, there's just preparations. It doesn't mean it's going to happen, but we've definitely seen an increase in the rhetoric. And some of the shots that have been fired recently, as I wrote in an article for The Forecaster on Wednesday, it's at least entertaining, if not decisive. But, for example, Greece, just in the last couple months, has decided that they are really going to try to press their claim for war reparations from Germany over Nazi occupation of the country 70-plus years ago. It's, of course, been something, I guess, of an issue that some people have brought up for the last several decades, but now suddenly they've put a price tag on it. And wouldn't you know it, that price tag is about, I think, 279 billion euros, which is 39 billion euros more than Greece owes to the European Central Bank. So,
well, isn't that just a coincidence?
One swift blow,
huh?
It's all taken care of.
Yeah, right. Not only that, you actually get money. You don't have to pay money.
Exactly.
It creates an excuse. They're asking for an excuse to just cut the debt. They're not asking that Germany hand over the dollars. They're giving, in a sense, they're giving Germany an excuse to say, all right, fine, we'll forget the debt if you forget this, all of these claims that you're making on the former, you know, essentially on Germany as the heir to Nazi Germany. I don't know. We've got a world where the Middle East is unstable and becoming increasingly volatile. Got a world where we're just now talking about a certain amount of demonstrations and implied instability in Europe. I don't know how much instability we have in Asia, Japan, and China, for example. Japan has a stable culture. China has still, there's something of a police state and a certain amount of repression where I don't think you'll see the open evidence of the instability there. But where in the world do we see stability right now?
I think, it might be better to ask where in the world isn't the instability. And I think you might be right. Japan, it's hard to imagine any sort of fundamental political change happening here in the foreseeable future, but I think that would be dependent on what happens with China and what's happening in the region. With China, I think you're right. I think that kind of instability could exist. I think it does exist to some extent, but we would never see it. I think that's the type of situation where if a real change was going to happen in China, it would seem like an overnight phenomenon.
Yeah.
And maybe something like the fall of the Berlin Wall or something like that, where it just seems to all occur at once. Because, again, it is such a heavily policed and controlled society that I don't think we would see those cracks until they're basically unstoppable. Mm-hmm. I'm not predicting any sort of major sea change in political situation in a lot of the Asia-Pacific region right now. I think that might be one of the more stable regions. But even so, I mean, having said that, obviously the economic problems are here. In Japan, certainly, and maybe in China as well. Some pretty worrying signs coming out from China, including the fact that Chinese tech stocks are in a bubble that actually puts the late 90s dot-com bubble to shame. Back in the late 90s, people might remember the NASDAQ went on its ridiculous run to the point where it was the average valuation of tech companies in the U.S. at that time was 156-1 in terms of price to earnings. Ridiculous valuation. Well, right now in the Chinese stock market, which is a $6.9 trillion stock market at this point, it is certainly growing. And the tech stocks now are valued at 220-1 price-to-earnings ratio. So it's even more ridiculous than the dot-com bubble. And that's just that one sign of many from China that there's some pretty significant problems there. So, again, there could be an economic catalyst to that leads to political changes or military confrontation. There could be some sort of people's uprising somewhere else in the world that has a knock-on effect. So I there's so many different vectors for instability that I'm not sure I could predict where would be a safe place in the world at this point.
I'm thinking perhaps South America.
Even there, I think there's a lot of political instability. And certainly in places like Venezuela, been a lot of political instability there and shenanigans. The Venezuelan government basically claiming that it's now part of, it's all a U.S. plot to overthrow their government. But, of course, it's at least to a certain extent, it's the socialist price controls and other things that have just crippled the Venezuelan economy. So now they're rationing toilet paper and everything else, basic goods. Argentina, of course, continuing to be on the brink. Brazil was doing good last decade, is not doing so good right now, economically speaking. So I think there's still a lot of economic and political instability in South America.
I can see economic, and I'm inclined to look at Uruguay and Argentina as fairly stable, even though I know Argentina has apparent problems. They always have problems. And the people, I've talked to someone who lives down there, and he's been on the program regularly in the past. South America seems fairly stable to me. It seems. The man I talked to, Roger Sales, he emphasized that they've gone through so much instability in Argentina that it doesn't bother them. Right? They're ready to deal with it. They'll get by. I don't mean that it won't be a problem, but it won't cause a revolution or a shooting revolution or whatever. It'll be another big deal. It'll be another small thing if they have a serious economic problem. So, yeah. But the point behind all of this is with all the instability in the world, it's not likely to hold together much longer. It seems like some of this is going to have to break loose sooner or later. And perhaps sooner rather than later, and we're going to have to explore that possibility another time because we're out of time. So I want to thank James Corbett for being on the program again. Always look forward to talking to you, James, and thank all of you folks for listening. I'll be back tomorrow. In the meantime, with the good Lord bless you, me, James, and Frank, the producer. Bye-bye.
Seems to be a single penny left for me.